This is the You Can Learn Chinese podcast, part of the Citican Network from SubChina. For everyone who's trying to learn Chinese or reaching for the next level, you came to the right place. I am your host, Jared Turner, longtime resident of China, co-founder of the Mandarin Companion Graded Reader Series, and like most men my age, I'm 41. My co-host is John Pazden, co-founder of Mandarin Companion, founder of All Set Learning, the Chinese Grammar Wiki, Sinosplice.com, and being his own worst enemy finally gives him a worthy opponent. Captions on videos. How helpful are they really? John and I are going to dive into the academic research on this topic so you can better understand how to maximize your learning gains with or without the captions. Guest interview is with Jeremy Bai, who turned his fascination with Chinese martial arts into a career of translating Chinese novels for a living. All this and more, let's get to it. Hey guys, this is Jared Turner coming at you from Utah in the United States.
Hi, Chinese learners. I am John Pazden, and I am in Shanghai, China.
Sure about that, John?
Quite sure.
All right. Before we kick into the episode, hey, just like to invite you to leave us a review. We love it when you leave a review. The best place to do that is on iTunes. It's the Apple Podcasts platform. Leave us a review. Let us know what you think of the show. Ask us any questions as well. You're also welcome to send us an email at feedback@mannercompanion.com. We love to hear from you guys, and that really helps us as well to get a little more visibility for the podcast. So feel free to do that.
Also, we've gotten some really good questions in the past, but haven't gotten any recently. We love to get questions, so send them in, and we will feature them if they're good. Okay, so in today's podcast, we're going to look at an academic paper. It is a paper called Factors Influencing the Use of Captions by Foreign Language Learners, an Eye-Tracking Study.
Ooh, fascinating.
So when they say captions, they're talking about, you know, closed captions, like subtitles. And specifically, they're talking about, you know, if you're studying Chinese, then the Chinese text is on the screen, right? Or if you're studying Arabic or Spanish, then that text is on the screen. And so they're using this eye-tracking technology with the idea that if you're looking at the text, then you're actually reading. And if you're not looking at the text, then probably you're listening and soaking in the visuals more.
So I'll break this down real quick on how they actually did this. So they tested Chinese learners, Arabic learners, Russian, and Spanish learners. And all these people were native English speakers, and they're studying in a university, so they're about in their fourth year of studying the language. And they took a video, something about bears and salmon. Is that right, John?
Yeah. Bears and salmon, what every language learner wants to watch.
Mm. There we go. That's prime content. Anyway, so they translated it into the target language, and they put subtitles on it. Then they put the people who they were studying for this in a room watching these with an eye-tracking software and you know hardware. They're tracking, seeing where their eyes are going. And they measured how long people were looking at the subtitles when they popped up or if they even looked at them at all.
And?
Then they took that data and analyzed it and tried to say, hey, you know, are we seeing any patterns here? Are there any differences between these different languages that people are learning? And what does this mean?
Okay, so conclusions?
So, surprise, surprise, they found on average, Chinese learners were spending more time looking at the subtitles than those people who were learning the other languages.
And is that because they couldn't understand what they were hearing or because they just wanted to read the characters?
So I think it's important to measure that they divided this content into things that were familiar to the speakers and unfamiliar. So they found that if it was familiar, like they were familiar with like the characters, the subtitles, maybe what was being talked about, the actual Chinese learners looked at it less than the other language learners did. But if it was more unfamiliar, characters they didn't know or subject matter they weren't as familiar with, they spent more time looking at the captions.
Okay, so am I correct in understanding that when they're watching something with familiar language, they look at the subtitles less because they're just like, ah, I don't need those Chinese characters, ugh. But if they don't actually understand what people are saying, they're like, well, guess I gotta read the characters because I can't understand by listening.
Well, it's interesting that they found, in general, there are four reasons why people will lean upon captions. So one reason is that it helps them to recognize words that they already know. So you hear it, then you see the
it represented. I mean, this doesn't matter what language you're learning. In fact, this even happens in your native language, like English. Maybe you heard something on screen and you weren't entirely sure, did you hear that clearly? Oh, there's a subtitle. Yeah, now I know clearly what's going on. Okay, the other thing is chunking streams of speech. So it's like, you hear all the stuff that's coming in, but, you know, when you can read it, it helps you just kind of like, recognize phrases and, kind of understand holistically what's going on. The other part is understanding novel words. So this may be something that, isn't infrequent or could be an exclamation or something, maybe you're not so clear on, but, that's maybe more unique. And then the fourth one is resolve ambiguity. All right, did I hear that right? Did I hear the ending right? Did they slough the words together, something like that? And you see the captions down there, and it can help. And so when you're looking at it this way, you're saying you have things that are familiar and unfamiliar speech. I think in Chinese in general, you're going to have some of those, if it's more difficult, for all of those reasons, you're going to want to look at the captions a little bit more than actually comparatively they found than those who are learning other languages.
Okay, so that's like the empirical results of the study. And in a sense, this isn't very useful to Chinese language learners. Maybe you learn differently than a Spanish or a Russian learner, but so what? Because you chose Chinese and you're going to learn Chinese and you're not going to switch because of something like this, right?
Yeah, we don't really care about the comparative aspect because that doesn't help you learn Chinese, right?
Well, I won't say I don't care because it is kind of interesting. And, we Chinese learners love to hear things like, oh, Chinese characters are so hard, because we're learning them, we're defeating them. And it's maybe a little ego boost. But it doesn't actually improve your studies to just know that. However, there were some other parts of the paper which I found useful, and it actually answers a specific question that learners frequently ask me. So let me read this part, Jared.
Okay.
When a video is played twice, once with captions and once without, would more vocabulary be acquired when the captioned video is played first or second? Participants included 150 native English-speaking learners of Arabic, Chinese, Spanish, and Russian. Each group watched 3 short videos and without captioning in a counterbalanced order. The learners also took comprehension vocabulary tests, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so for Arabic and Chinese, there was a trend toward captioning second being more effective.
Okay, so John, that means it was more effective to watch the video first without captions and then watch it again with captions. Is that what you're saying?
Right, that's what the study found. And then learners of a language whose orthography is closer to that of the target language may be better able to use the written modality as an initial source of information. Okay, so in other words,
put down vernacular for us, Johnny.
All right, so in other words, if you're not having to deal with a very foreign script, then it's easier to take in information from the subtitles, the captions.
Hmm.
So in the cases of, languages like Chinese, learners may have to rely on listening more because the written symbols are not well learned. So you can imagine a situation where you're watching a video and you can understand a lot of what's being said, but you don't necessarily know all those characters. So that's the kind of situation where they're talking about here. And one thing that we really need to keep in mind when we're thinking about how to use video, like with or without these subtitles, is how difficult is it? Because if it's not difficult, then the input without subtitles shouldn't be too bad, and it's probably going to be good listening practice, even if it's a little bit of a stretch for you. And I think that's a good use case where you could first listen, without subtitles, and then watch again just to make sure you understood everything correctly.
Yeah, I like to pull that back into an overarching principle of, comprehensible input. And we talk about extensive reading, on this show a lot. Extensive reading is a branch, if you will, a subset. It falls underneath the whole concept of comprehensible input. So, and I think that's essentially what you're getting at, John, is try to, let's try to, if you possible, let's listen, watch, read things that should be comprehensible to us that, hopefully have a higher level of comprehension.
All right. And if you can find video which is mostly comprehensible, then great. The only problem is that can be quite difficult, especially if you're at a lower level. So if you're at a lower level, you're probably going to need to find materials that have been created just for learners. Or if you're trying to watch real videos meant for native speakers, then you can probably only handle carefully selected clips from a longer video. But again, if you can get that kind of comprehensible input, that's the best kind of video for you to watch.
So I think let's balance that out a little bit too. Like there are, for example, a lot of shows on Netflix, Disney Plus, where you can get Mandarin subtitles. But those shows, I mean, unless you're at a higher level, I would say, you know, upper intermediate, you know, even at that level, it could be a bit challenging. So it's, once again, as John's pointing out there, is like, but start looking for things, especially at most people listening here are going to be in this range of things that are written specifically for learners. Now, something that we did find, John, when we did a resurvey a couple months ago now, we found that a lot of you guys are listening to YouTube videos or you're watching YouTube videos because, frankly, there is a lot of content out there. Now, yeah, I got a lot of variance in quality, but there are a lot of good YouTube resources. Also, things on Instagram. There's all these people there, TikTok, all these things where people are producing content that is targeted and directed at learners like you.
And then you can get something that's kind of similar if you're listening to pure audio, because you know there are resources like ChinesePod and some of these other audio providers where you have the text and then you have the audio. So then one question I get for that, which is very similar to the video question, is should I just listen to the audio without reading, or should I read it first? Or should I listen and follow along reading as I'm listening? And yeah, this is kind of similar, where if you're trying to really improve your listening comprehension and the audio isn't too difficult for you, then it's definitely very good to listen first without any text and then look at the text later to help fill in any little gaps or to, you know, resolve any ambiguity.
So now, you know, we're kind of bleeding over here, you know, a little bit, saying, you know, we're talking about videos first with subtitles, but also audio that has a transcription. But, you know, which one should you do? I think my answer is yes. If it's comprehensible for you, yes, do it, whether it's video or audio. Because at the end of the day, you know, the listening is listening. Obviously, you have video and you can see the person speaking. That definitely adds another dimension and can definitely help with your comprehension and understanding what is being said. But if you don't have that and you have a transcription and it's comprehensible, it's still helpful. It's still great.
Okay, but we should talk about a situation which is very common, which is I've got the Chinese video. It has subtitles in Chinese, but it's super hard for me. So what should I do? So I think this is very similar to intensive reading, where you're trying to read some text, but you don't know a bunch of the words and characters. And in this case, the video is probably just going to be frustrating and confusing if you don't use subtitles at all and you try to like get through it without using any subtitles and just somehow figure out what they're talking about. So in cases like that, you shouldn't feel bad about using the subtitles. In that case, you're actually much more likely to learn something.
Agreed. And there are some suggestions that they give in this paper to teachers. Now, this may not apply to you per se. Maybe you don't have a tutor going through this with you. But if you are encountering that and you do want to watch some shows or videos and the level is challenging, maybe it's a stretch for being a comprehensible input, they suggest that, you know, you don't just put a video on and just watch the whole thing. Feel free to stop and maybe discuss what was going on. If you have a friend or a tutor or a language buddy or something like that, try to, you know, stop. You can rewind. Nowadays we skip back, right? Be kind, rewind. And then, you know, discuss what was going on, maybe review again. And as if there's an instructor, you know, they could actually prepare something and maybe have little drills or just multiple choice questions or something just to help check your comprehension and discuss, hey, find out if you're having any troubles in different areas. So that's an important thing, is that break it up into smaller chunks as opposed to just plowing through a whole show.
But if you don't have someone helping you, that's still a good thing to do. So just tackle a chunk, you know, maybe it's a scene or a 5-minute segment, whatever, and then try to get through it, even though it's hard for you, without looking up every word. Don't just like pause after they say one thing. Try to get through just this section, because by the end of the section, you might have a better idea of what some of those words mean. And by letting your brain like try to figure it out, you're actually doing more learning than if you had just looked up the word immediately as soon as they said it the first time. So then when you finish that scene and then go back and then look at it again line by line, you'll probably be looking up fewer words and you'll have a better idea of what they mean already, which means it's going to stick better. Okay, and then there's just one other situation I wanted to mention, which is sometimes the movie, like Chinese movies do this sometimes, has subtitles, but you can't remove the English. Like maybe you can see the English and the Chinese at the same time. And so people have asked me before, oh, is it even worth it to try to watch the movie if I can't take away the English? Or I want to watch the movie and I want to read the English, but is that helping my Chinese? And I would say, don't worry about it. Just watch it. Try to pick up words or phrases here or there, but I don't think you're really hurting yourself by just going easy on yourself with some English and some of the movies, and you might still pick stuff up. Like I remember when I was in my first year of Chinese studies, I watched a Chinese movie called To Live, Huojia. And it was in Chinese with Chinese and English subtitles. And I think I just picked up like a few words or phrases. It was like, oh yeah, I know that. You know, 不知道, you know, like I know that. I know that phrase. But it actually had some of the deepest impressions of any Chinese I've ever learned from video. So, you know, just give it a try.
Yeah, I love that example, John, because one thing that is kind of encouraging is, you know, you maybe your Chinese level isn't great. You know some phrases, words, maybe you're barely conversational. But when you're watching something and you hear something you know, it's like, oh, I got that, you know, and it can be motivating. And it is something, yeah, I do recall time seeing or early on some things in, you know, shows, whatever, and hearing a phrase like, you know, I'm like, oh, okay, I've heard that before. Now it makes sense. You know, you can see it in context and everything. So yeah, don't be afraid. You know, if it's just there, feel free to watch it. English subtitles, whatever. A good example I mentioned on the last podcast was Shang-Chi just came out. Now, like I said, quite a bit of the movie is in Chinese, but of course there's English subtitles. But you're still going to hear some of the words that you know and phrases, and it's going to be fun. So go out there and get it. But real quick, just want to highlight a couple resources that might be helpful to you. Of course, recommend YouTube. I don't even have a specific channel. But you should go out there and you can look and you can find YouTube videos in Chinese, specifically for learners on all sorts of subjects. And so get out there. You can find something that's going to be of interest to you. Another platform that might be helpful to you is FluentU. Now, it does charge money. I think their subscription is like $20 a month. But they take this approach and they take videos that are supposed to be at specific levels and they put subtitles on them and sometimes build little lessons around them. And that's really what they focus on. And a lot of people do find a lot of value out of that.
Yeah, but if you have the time and you don't have a lot of budget, you can definitely find good stuff on YouTube. You're just going to have to filter out a bunch of videos where, you know, people are using a lot of English and there's not a whole lot of Chinese, if that's what you're looking for.
Oh, real quick, I should say FluentU is FluentU, the letter U, not Y-O-U.
Okay, so in summary, what we have learned from this paper is that people who are learning Chinese treat subtitles differently. And for you as a learner, it just means that, you know, you need to kind of keep in mind how you want to learn from videos, have a strategy. This does not mean that you should jump ship and learn Spanish, because Chinese is still awesome and you can learn Chinese.
You can definitely learn Chinese. All right, now it's time for a word from our sponsor. And today our sponsor is
Mandarin Companion Memes.
That's right. Now, if you have been living under a rock or disconnected from social media, you may not be aware that we have a very popular Chinese language learning meme account. So if you like Chinese, if you're learning Chinese, and if you enjoy humor in any remote sense, then this is for you. Now, we have our memes. We publish one pretty much every weekday on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. So you can follow us. We'll put a link in the show notes. But the memes are, John, do you find them humorous?
I do, Jared. Not every single one, I gotta admit. Where do these memes even come from? Do you just like find them online, Jared?
I make these memes up. I like to think of so much fun. A lot of people, I guess thousands of people. We have probably 30,000 followers. No, actually about 35,000 followers between all of our platforms. So yeah, it was something, you know, John, the story on this, I created my first meme, Chinese language learning meme, about 3 years ago for an article that I had written for our website. And it went viral. Well, as viral as things do in the Chinese language learning community, right? And after that, I was like, oh, all right, maybe I'll make a couple more memes. And then a little while later, then I started publishing memes and started this Instagram account. And so here we are. And I'm starting to get them out as well on YouTube, and of course, might be getting more on TikTok. So they're pretty funny. At least not all of them are funny, you know? I mean, you just got to keep trying, right?
Yeah, there are definitely some good ones. And just so there's no doubt, I was joking. I know Jared spends quite a bit of time thinking up memes and creating memes. So got to give credit where credit is due. Jared is the meme master of Manner Companion.
Oh, shucks, man.
Okay, so we should go out and find these meme accounts on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, right?
That's right. Just search Mandarin Companion, find our page, and start enjoying memes.
Get memes.
All right, now it's time for rants and raves. John, what do you have for us today? Do you have a rant or do you have a rave?
I have kind of a rant, I guess. So you know how in China, like, hot pot is a big thing, both hot pot and Mongolian hot pot, and you make the sauce with different things in it, and it's really good, you know, especially the meat, but I love the vegetables too.
My favorite is ji gong bao. It's the Chongqing style hot pot. Well, it's not just the style. Anyway, go on.
All right. Anyway, you have your sauce, and they give you this minced garlic. And, you know, garlic's good, so I always put lots of garlic in there. But, man, every time I have a hot pot, like the next day I have this garlic hangover. Like,
oh, no.
My whole mouth is just like stained with garlic flavor, and my tongue is like a garlic marinated slug. I don't know. It's is this a rant? I don't know. But
I don't know. But you're making me hungry, John.
Does this happen to you with American food that has garlic? Because it only ever happens to me in China.
Well, I mean, I'll admit, John, I don't usually eat, the equivalent of multiple cloves of garlic in a meal. But in hot pot, I think I probably do.
Yeah, China encourages you to do it, and there are consequences, but it's still worth it. Okay, so Jared, you got a rant or a rave?
Okay.
What?
Quite so, John, but I'm still curious. Was that a rant or a rave?
A little bit of both. Oh, we'll call it a rant.
A rant rave. A rant rave, I think.
Okay, so Jared, what do you got?
Okay, John, you know, funny enough, I've got a rave tonight. And it is in the same vein as you, because it's something that I really miss about China. Now, last time I was in China was in January of 2020. I left a week before the pandemic shut China down. And I haven't been back since. And I have been having a craving, John. I've been having craving for street food, specifically like those guys that make the kebabs on the side of the street. So I'm throwing this out there, guys. All right. If you get the chance to go to China, and I think Taiwan will have this, some of these guys too, right? But typically you got these guys on the side of the road, they're selling these little lamb kebabs, and they put some cumin on it and some peppers and some chili stuff, and it is just the best. I mean, I just miss those, man. You know, you're walking down the side of the road and the guy's got his little grill out there and he's frying them, and you know, I'm like, I'll take five or something, and it's just one of the best midnight snack. Well, yeah, sometimes I don't get started, you know, set up to like midnight or something. But, you know, some of the best snacks out there. You got to try the kebabs or chuar, right? I can't even say that right, because that's what they have in Beijing. But in Shanghai, you know, it's going to be the Yangrou, you know, all that type of stuff. Anyway, but it's fantastic. You got to try it. John, when's the last time you've had one?
I don't know, man. Maybe I'm a bit of a kebab snob, but I like street food, but not really the kebabs. Like, I have some places I really like the kebabs. I don't really, I feel like the kebabs on the street just keep getting smaller and smaller, and the meat is kind of questionable. But there's plenty of other good street food.
What do you think the meat is?
I'm not saying it's, you know, some other animal. I'm just saying it's...
Not saying it's a domestic animal, are you?
maybe not the freshest is what I'm suggesting. So,
fresh or not, it's still good.
But things change, Jared. I don't know. Maybe the China kebab situation is not what it once was. Have to get over here and investigate.
One day I shall return and I shall consume kebabs to my heart's content.
And you'll pay for it the next day.
Hey, John, I have a cast iron stomach. I can take it.
We'll see.
My pen name is Jeremy Bai, and I'm also known online as Deathblade. I have a YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/Deathblade. So I currently have a few different hats that I wear, and they all revolve around Chinese fantasy genres of fiction, specifically wuxia and xianxia, and also xuanhuan.
If you have read any English translations of Chinese fantasy novels, you may have read one of Jeremy's translations. He's translated more books than you can shake a stick at. But one thing I really like about Jeremy is how down to earth he is, knowing there's always something new to learn. Stay with us.
So, why did you start learning Chinese?
Basically, when the movie Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon came out in 2000 in the United States, it really sparked my interest in that genre of fiction and also Chinese culture in general. So for about 7 years, I was obsessed with it. And then in 2007, I traveled to China for vacation. I actually skipped my graduation to go to China. This is another really stupid thing, and I haven't revealed this publicly. I actually couldn't afford to take a trip to China at that time. Basically, long story short is I got extra school loan money and then used the school loan money to take a trip to China. Before going into that vacation, I had maybe a year before or something, I'd had this stupid idea. I was like, you know what? I'm going to get some language CDs and I'm gonna learn Mandarin so that I can watch Chinese movies in Mandarin and I not have to read the subtitles. And so I had made sort of like a half-hearted attempt. I even started with Cantonese for a little bit. Then I went to Mandarin. I guess it could work for some geniuses to like use language CDs to understand movies, but not really going to work for most people. So I kind of gave up. And then when it came time for the vacation, I went through it all again. You know, the Pimsleur like 30 CD set, you know, how to ask to go to the restroom or whatever it was. That is kind of where I officially started, I would say, down the language learning path.
All right. So you went to China. How long was that trip for? And what was your experience like going there the first time?
I did one of those standard tours, like Beijing and then Xi'an, and then went down to, I'm pretty sure, Chongqing, visited the Three Gorges Dam, then down the river to, I believe it was Suzhou, and going through Guilin, and then finally ending in Hong Kong. And that was a guided tour with everything paid for. They take you to hotels, your guide speaks English. And so during that trip, I think maybe I one time said something like, you know, "洗手间在哪儿" or something like that. I forget, but I basically didn't use any Chinese. And then in 2009, I took a trip. Now, during that trip, I had been studying Chinese for 2 years. I didn't do a guided tour. I did everything myself and basically did everything in Chinese. And so that was a completely different experience. I think both experiences were great, and I would highly recommend anybody who is able to afford it, don't get school loans to do it. I do not recommend that. But if you can afford it, either one is great. If you are an absolute beginner, don't know anything about Chinese or Chinese culture, do the guided tour, go to the nice hotels, have the tour guide take you places. Be prepared for the tour guide to take you to every single spot where you could possibly spend money, and then they try to get you to spend money. That's fine. It's part of the whole experience. That's great. And then if you have been studying Chinese for a few years and you have a command of the basic kind of language, you're comfortable having a very short conversation, checking into a hotel, although nowadays pretty much everybody at the hotel speaks English, but that's also a great experience.
So well, I want to hear a little bit of the details here, Jeremy. Is that, okay, you went to China, you went on this trip, 2 years later you went back, and okay, now I've got some Chinese under my belt. But like, what were you doing? And what was really your motivation at that time to say, hey, I really want to start learning this language?
It was really just an obsession. I was struck by that China bug that some people get. I really wanted to learn the language. I was really in love with the culture, or at least what I perceived the culture to be. You know, I got to go to the Forbidden City and see it with my own eyes. Now, I mentioned the wuxia stuff. Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon is a wuxia genre. That's fantasy martial arts. Some people don't like calling it fantasy. I call it fantasy because I think it's too fantastic to be real. And a lot of times it's historical in nature as well, but I think it's just beyond reality, so I call it fantasy. I was especially obsessed with that, and I read everything I could get my hands on, not Chinese, but the fan translations. I'm talking in the period between 2000 and 2007. So when I took that 2007 trip, I actually printed out the Return of the Condor Heroes by Jin Yong, which is probably one of Jin Yong's most famous and most beloved works. I printed that out on 8.5 by 11 paper. I think I got it bound at the local FedEx or something. And I read that on my trip to China. And, you know, while I'm floating down the Yangtze River, reading wuxia in China, it just was like this really life-changing experience. So I got back and I was just like, I want to do this. I want to learn more. I don't want to just be able to say ni hao and where's the bathroom. I want to do more. And so I started with that crash course that I mentioned. It was free, and it was just, you know, they teach you the basics. They had us using one of those, I think it was the new Chinese reader.
Practical Chinese reader, yes.
Yeah, that's the one. But we didn't really do much from that, to be honest. And the teacher was like this old guy who had spent a lot of time in Taiwan. Like, he could speak perfect like Mandarin. I mean, his accent was weird. But he was kind of just this old, crazy guy that didn't honestly have a very good teaching method. So I didn't really learn much in that class, but I did learn pinyin. And then from there, everything was self-taught. So I never took a class again. And I went through a whole variety of different methods and a lot of spaced repetition. I used Scritter for a long time. I think I did Anki for a while. I watched movies. I used the method where, you know, you watch the subtitles and you turn the subtitles off. And then I would watch with the Chinese subtitles and I would break it down to watch every single scene, break down all the Chinese characters to make sure I understood them, then rewatch it. I got a language exchange tutor after about maybe 3 years or so. I kind of fell into a rhythm of what worked for me, and that was primarily spaced repetition. And so I would spend at least an hour or two every day reviewing vocabulary. I also got into translating, which I mentioned before. That came out around year four when I realized that my reading ability was extremely low and I needed to get better at reading. And so I started by reading a wuxia novel, and then I translated that very same novel initially as a way to force myself to read. And then that led to doing fan translations of wuxia novels, and then that in turn led to doing it professionally.
Wow. It sounds like you, yeah, you were very passionate. You said, I think you used the word obsessed, right?
Yeah. Immediately after coming back, almost, I got a job. And then I moved from that job to another job in the same industry that was in Manhattan. I was actually in the financial district of Manhattan, right next to the World Trade Center. Our office looked down into the wreckage of the 9/11 attack. I mean, the attack was obviously years before I moved there, but they were still digging and starting to build. I moved to Chinatown during that time because I thought, why not move to Chinatown? I've been studying Chinese and whatnot. And so I would listen to podcasts on the way to and from work. Then in the evening, you know, spend 30 minutes here or an hour there doing some spaced repetition, watch a movie, watch a TV show. It was just all kind of relaxed. And granted, I did work a lot. I worked really hard for several years straight. And after that, life kind of got in the way because I was in China and I ended up getting married and having a kid. And then that kind of throws everything into chaos. But during the time in which I was studying very hard, I tried to keep a good balance. And I think I did.
You know, what I like about hearing your story here, Jeremy, is that when I talk to people, you know, hey, how can I learn Chinese? What's the best way? Well, there's a lot of ways to learn a language. Some are going to be more effective than others, but they all can work. And it's really about that time that you put in, right? And that effort. And it sounds to me that you put in 1 to 2 hours a day, sometimes maybe more.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think that above all, that is one of the keys. Obviously, you're going to have to spend your time wisely. Like, for instance, a lot of people, my perception is that there are people who, for instance, really like Chinese TV shows or something. And granted, Chinese TV shows can be a great language learning tool, but just watching them is not necessarily going to do anything for you. So you can't just think that you're going to sit down and watch. I remember thinking that when I was young about like anime or stuff. I'd be like, if I watch this enough, I'm eventually going to pick up some stuff and be able to understand it. No, you have to work efficiently for sure. And so that's what I tried to do. And in my experience, like I mentioned, I was able to do a trip to China all on my own, going from city to city and everything without a translator, without a tour guide or anything after only 2 years. So I think that if you're putting significant work into it, it's not a process that takes forever. You can get to a really good level of fluency in a couple years. And to be honest, I feel like I could have been more efficient and probably worked a little bit harder.
Can you think of any experiences or stories about when you used to realize, oh, wow, I'm really getting somewhere with my Chinese?
The 2009 trip to China was definitely a kind of a watershed moment. But the pastry shops, the bakeries in Manhattan, Chinatown are just amazing. I mean, they have like egg tarts and pineapple buns that are better than China. But in any case, there were a few instances at bakeries or tea shops or something where I was in Manhattan, Chinatown. I finally got up the gumption to order in Chinese and they understood me. And I think the workers at those places, you know, they're used to a lot of people being able to speak Chinese. So it wasn't like they were that shocked. They weren't surprised or anything. I just, you know, I ordered in Chinese and then they were like, okay, give me your money. And then I was like off to the side waiting for my food. And I was like, wow, I actually just talked to somebody in Chinese. It was crazy.
I got treated like a normal person.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I'm not exactly very outgoing and I wouldn't call myself brave in terms of like those kind of like, I'm going to jump out and start speaking Chinese. It took a lot of courage for me to do that. So those were some very key moments. And I think it was those moments that actually gave me the confidence to be able to do that 2009 trip where I went without a tour guide and just did everything on my own.
Wow, that's pretty cool. I give this analogy sometimes to people saying, do you compliment a Chinese person's English every time you speak to them? Especially if they're highly fluent, right? It's almost insulting to say, oh, your English is really good. And it's kind of, well, yeah, duh. You know, everyone can tell. It's like apparent. So yeah. I think sometimes when your Chinese is good enough, people don't compliment it. You're like, now you know you've arrived.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, Jeremy, you know, what we do at Manner Companion, you know, we easy to read novels, you know, Chinese graded readers. But now you jumped and you went, hey, straight to a wuxia novel, right? That is no small feat. So what was your experience doing that the first time?
It's a little bit complicated because the truth is that I actually failed the first time I tried to do it. When I was living in Manhattan, I tried it. I believe I picked up a Jin Yong novel, but it might have been a Gulong novel. I can't remember. And I tried to do it, and it was just too hard, and I gave up. Then, if I was going to put a date on it, I guess it would probably be 2014. I decided to try again. I was a little intimidated because I remembered that previous failure, and I was kind of nervous to try.
Now, real quick, you said failure. What do you mean by failure?
Well, it was too slow. I was thinking, I can just use a pop-up dictionary, and that'll make it easy. Now, granted, pop-up dictionaries help for sure, but I started reading and it was every other word I just didn't get. Now some of this is because wuxia is not exactly necessarily the easiest thing to understand for a beginner. There are unique terms and even the names don't necessarily correspond to what modern Chinese people are going to use for names. You know, it would be probably as difficult as if a Chinese person learning English suddenly picked up Game of Thrones and tried to start reading it in English, which incidentally, my wife tried to do that. And it basically was the same as with me picking up wuxia. It's like, the idea is cool, but then you start realizing how difficult the language aspects are. So for me, when I say failure, I think I read like the equivalent of like a page. And even with a pop-up dictionary, it was going so slow. I was just like, this is impossible. I'm not going to be able to do this. So I was like, forget it. I'll wait till my Chinese is a little bit better.
That's a good move. I mean, we actually had a podcast. We talked about these pop-up dictionaries. You know, it's side note here, you know, that the research shows that if you're lower level Chinese, the pop-up dictionary, and you're reading something that's very difficult, the pop-up dictionaries actually don't give you a lot of learning gains because you spend so much time understanding it in English and focusing on the pinyin. Right. But if you're a higher level, they can actually just improve your reading experience because you have a more base to stand on. So,
first of all, 100% agree with you. But so my experience going down the translating path has been good and bad. Good side is that obviously I have read a massive amount of Chinese. And so my reading ability in Chinese has improved, you know, quite a bit. The downside is that my spoken Chinese hasn't improved that much. We haven't talked about this much in the podcast so far, but I am a translator and I have translated a lot of Chinese so far in my career, about 14 million Chinese characters. And if you convert that into words, now this isn't an exact science, but my experience, roughly speaking, it's probably around 8 or 9 million words. And for those of you who don't know much about word count in, for instance, novels, Harry Potter is about 1 million words, the entire series. So I've translated the equivalent of the Harry Potter series about 8 or 9 times over. And that involves, my process will be reading the what I am translating before I translate it. Then I read it while I'm translating it. And then there's a lot of research and different things like that. So however many Chinese characters I've translated, I've read that number of Chinese characters probably several times over. And I use pop-up dictionaries while I'm translating. There's, you know, Buddhist terms and classical Chinese. There's just a lot of stuff that I couldn't possibly know off the top of my head. What I can tell you is that using those pop-up dictionaries, it increases the speed with which I can translate and the speed with which I can read. Because, of course, obviously, if I wanted to look it up in a dictionary the traditional way, or even look it up in an online dictionary, you know, I could spend 3 times as much time doing that or more. When I'm translating and trying to, you know, maintain a certain speed of translation, being able to just put the mouse over, pop up the word, I'm like, okay, that's what that means. I continue with my work. It makes it my work more efficient and faster. And I can tell you that it improved my reading ability dramatically. When I first started, I had to look up a lot of stuff while I was reading my initial read through. It got to the point, you know, in the last year or two where I don't really even need to use the dictionary to read. Now, that doesn't mean I understand every single thing, but I also don't understand every single thing I read in English. I mean, I look up words in English, you know, like when I read fantasy novels as well. So I was able to reach the point of actually, I'm pretty confident in saying, when reading for fun, I can read about as fast in Chinese as I can in English. Maybe even faster, because for the past roughly 5 years, I have basically not really read any English and only read Chinese.
I think that's a wonderful frame of reference for anyone out there, because, you know, it can be discouraging, right? You spend years, you say, oh, maybe I even know a few, you know, 3,000 characters, and then you pick up something and you're like, I have no idea what this is. But from what I'm hearing from you is that maybe that doesn't happen to you very often at this stage, but it can still occur.
I can guarantee you no one will ever reach the point, no language learner will ever reach the point where they literally understand everything. The reason being that not even native Chinese speakers understand everything. For instance, in my translating work, for the most part, I work at home, which is lucky because my wife is a full-time mom and she's also at home, and that makes it very easy. When I don't understand something, I can ask her, and I frequently run into things that she doesn't understand in these fantasy novels, because it's a fantasy novel. The Chinese fantasy novels tap into stuff that the average Chinese person doesn't know. But when I was back in China and was explaining to my mother-in-law what I do for work, now my mother-in-law is pretty traditional Chinese. She can say like hello and a few things like that, but she doesn't speak English. So we speak in Chinese. And when I explained to her that I was translating xianxia xiaoshuo, she didn't know what I was talking about. She didn't know what xianxia is, because she's a little bit too old for that. It's the more younger crowd understands what xianxia is. Xianxia being similar to wuxia. Wuxia, it's a complicated character, but basically it means a hero. So like wuxia is martial heroes. And xianxia, xian is immortal. And so the xianxia is immortal heroes genre. But again, you know, older people don't necessarily know that. And then my wife is just a typical young Chinese woman, you know, went to college and you got her degree and stuff. But she doesn't know like Buddhist scriptures and stuff like that. So if I go to her with this like Buddhist thing, she'll be like, I don't know what that is. And she has to, you know, do her own research to figure it out.
Wow, that's interesting. Well, you know, maybe you could tell us a little bit more, like pull back the curtain. What is it like to translate something? What is that process like for you to take a novel that's in Chinese and get it totally like to something that's entertaining and readable in English?
It's an awesome thing, but it's just fun. It's a learning process while you're doing it. And I'm generally a creative person. When I went back to college, I got a degree in art and I enjoy drawing. I enjoy writing. And so it's a way to kind of mix creativity and language learning. And I learned a lot while doing it as well. I mean, there are massive amounts of cultural, mythological aspects, religious aspects that I obviously didn't know about before I got into it.
Well, Jeremy, what's something about translating from Chinese to English, or translating these types of novels, or just, you know, in general, that people just don't know, or even maybe a misconception about how this is all done?
I think people don't realize how much of an effect the translator has on the final product. And that becomes obvious when you check what machine translation sounds like. Now, machine translation for like legal documents and things like that actually many times is very efficient and works great. And you can, like, for instance, contracts, because I've signed a lot of contracts with Chinese companies and whatnot, and sometimes they'll just Google, Baidu, whatever machine translation software they're using, and it basically sounds pretty good. Maybe there's a few spots that aren't that good. But you try to do that with fiction, and it doesn't work as well. Obviously, the author's writing style does affect that. Some authors write in a more simple way than others. But basically, you try to machine translate fiction, and you're going to miss the feeling of the fiction. And so that brings into question, what is the feeling that this fiction is supposed to evoke in the reader? Now, because we're talking about fiction, my personal philosophy is that that feeling is extremely important. My philosophy as a translator is that I want the reader to experience this work of fiction as closely as possible to the way that a native Chinese speaker would when they were reading it. So that affects things, for instance, like cuss words, humor, poetry, things like that. There's a lot of Chinese cuss words that translators have to choose. Am I going to translate this directly and literally to maintain the accuracy of what the Chinese characters say? Or am I going to translate it in a way that is going to be more accessible to the reader, but might not necessarily be perfectly accurate compared to what the Chinese says? And for fiction translators, there's a constant balance between those two different things. And there's a lot of different schools of thought. There's some really famous translators who have translated works, like, for instance, the translator of Three Body Problem, who, based on my understanding, I mean, he says it in his translator notes in the book that he favors a more direct translation. I favor the less accurate but more faithful to the feeling. And I have talked to, you know, authors of the works that I translate. Primarily, one of the authors is named Argun. He's a pretty prolific author. His works are now, you know, being made into anime shows and live action TV shows and whatnot, games and all those different things. And I have met him a few times in person. We were talking about this, and I didn't ask him, by the way. He was the one that brought it up. He was like, how did you translate this specific song in the novel that I was translating for him? And the reason was because it's a xianxia novel, so the general setting resembles some kind of fantasy, mythical, ancient China. But this author likes to throw in a lot of pop culture references. And I'm sure you know, remember that Little Apple song that was like super famous? So he put a version of that into his novel as a joke. Like the niche or what, that one? Okay. Except he changed a couple little words, but then he put it into his novel as a joke. And so he was asking me about how I translated it. And then before I even answered, he was like, you know what? It doesn't matter. He's like, just change it to whatever is a popular song in English right now. He's like, I want to make sure that the audience laughs and they understand it. So that was kind of his take on it as well. Was he's writing these things that the Chinese audience will laugh at, or they'll say, whoa, that's cool.
I got to know, how did you translate that, Jeremy?
That novel was I Shall Steal the Heavens, which you can get on Amazon now in ebook format. And that was way early in my translating career. And that Little Apple song reference was within the first couple hundred chapters of the book. So to put that into context, that book is 1,600 chapters. And the novel I translated after that was 1,300 chapters. And the novel I translated after that was 1,600 chapters. So this is very, very early in my translating career. And I directly translated it.
Oh, so, okay, okay.
And what I did was I directly translated it, I mean, in a way that sounded good. And then I put a footnote explaining what it was. And then I put a link to this actual song that you could find on YouTube and stuff. And so I didn't meet him, the author, until probably something like a year and a half later. My philosophy of translating has changed a lot over the years. When I was first translating that very first novel that kicked off my career, so to speak, I took pride in directly translating everything. And to be honest with you, it comes across sounding really bad. I went back years later afterwards to edit that novel, I Shall Steal the Heavens, which you can now get on Amazon. And I hated the first several hundred chapters. It sounded so bad to me because I was so insistent on translating everything really accurately and directly. It just came across sounding really bad. So that was a lesson that I learned the hard way.
Wow, that is really interesting. Well, Jeremy, you've done so much translation, and I know you said that, you know, reading it doesn't improve your speaking. Well, there is research that shows it does, but I know that even as much as you read, I mean, there's no way that your reading cannot have an impact, you know, on your language usage or whatever. So I'm curious about, like, with all the reading and all your experience in that, how has that impacted how you actually speak Chinese or how you've used Chinese in your life?
Well, first of all, I got to admit, you are right. I do notice that I have improved in certain aspects of my speech without even realizing it. But to answer your question, one of the biggest things is that I tend to speak in Wuxia-like language a lot of times, and my wife gets annoyed by this a lot of the time. When it came time to name our son, he was born in China. We were struggling with what to name him in Chinese, and I was throwing out all these like really edgy Wuxia names. Like people in Wuxia will have names like, there's this one guy from one of the novels I translated, Xiao Lei Xue. Lei is tear, and Xue means blood. So his name was like Blood Tears or something. And so I was throwing out all these cool names, and she was just giving me this like deadpan stare and was like, no, our kid will get laughed out of school if he has that name. And then I tend to throw in a lot of these funny cliche words that get used a lot in Wuxia and Xianxia, whether it's the Taoist terminology that gets thrown around a lot. Like, for instance, in a lot of these novels, the characters call each other Daoyo. So instead of Pengyo, they use Dao, like from Taoism, and it's like Taoist friend or fellow Taoist. And I throw a lot of these things in as jokes. There's other things that are more practical. Like, for instance, there's a really common term that you see, not just in Wuxia, you'll see this everywhere, but it's the term Laozi. And Lao, like old, and Zi, like child. But you look it up in the dictionary and you see it translated as this old man, or I your father, or something like that, which I hate that literal translation. It completely loses the feeling. A lot of the readers of the novels kind of like that direct translation, and you'll see them using it online and stuff like that. But the truth is that that term is pretty common even nowadays. But like, guys will use this, friends will use it with each other, kind of like joking around. It basically is a third person form of address, which in English, we don't use third person very commonly. In China, it's very common to use it. This third person form of address is a way to essentially make yourself superior to the person you're talking to, and kind of like say, I'm better than you, tougher than you. I've used that in real life before. It's kind of insulting, but I have used it. There was one time when on the way home from the school that I worked at, I would usually drive a scooter, like a electric bike. And for years, I would stop at the mall. And at a certain point, after years of having just stopped and parked on the side, a guy shows up who's trying to take money. Now, if you've lived in China, in a place where they have bikes and motorbikes, it's pretty common for the main parking areas to be patrolled by people who will charge money, presumably to watch your bike. But in my experience, they don't actually do anything to benefit you or your bike. When the guy suddenly started charging money at the place where I had been parking for literally years for free, I got really upset with him, and I was like, what are you talking about? And so I was using Laozi. I was like, I've been here for years, like using this like condescending language, trying to sound like a tough guy. I even threw in a name of a gangster that I knew, and not that I was associated with lots of gangsters, but everybody in town knew him. So I was like trying to impress this like guy that was trying to charge me one renminbi to park my bike. But I was like, I know this, his name was Sangha, like third brother. I was like, I know third brother, I'm gonna call him if I have to. So anyway, your question was about how it affects me in real life. And it has affected me in that I pick up some of that kind of fantasy martial arts language and end up using it a lot more than an ordinary person probably would.
Well, Jeremy, if you could go back and do any part of your Chinese learning experience differently, what would you do and why?
That's a very easy question to answer. And the answer is that I would start with Chinese characters from the very beginning. When I started, I had the mistaken belief that I didn't need to learn Chinese characters. I was like, opinion's fine, it's good enough. But if you were taking it seriously, you got to learn the Chinese characters, you have to learn how to read. I delayed that for a good 2 or 3 years. During the first year or two, I was half-heartedly kind of like, oh, there's the character for you, I know that one. And there's the character for to want, I know that one. But that was useless to me when I came to China, and when I moved to China in 2010, and literally I couldn't understand anything. And then I started up the process, and here I am today, being a translator and quite good at reading Chinese characters. But it would have been a lot better to start from the beginning, definitely. And the other thing is that I wish I had made more concerted efforts to keep up some sort of spoken Chinese routine. My spoken Chinese has suffered because of translating and working in an English environment. And my now wife, when we were dating, we had this arrangement where we would very specifically only speak English on specific days. Basically, Monday, Wednesday, Friday was English, and then Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday was Chinese, and then Sunday was mixed. As life went on, we had kids and all that stuff. That fell to the wayside, and we ended up defaulting to English because she was better at it. When we have arguments and fights, I couldn't hold my own in Chinese, so I would always switch to English. And so because of that, that also factored into my lack of progress with speaking. So I would wish I could kind of go back and be more rigorous about enforcing that every other day, or what if I didn't do that, some other way to make sure that I was really continuing to practice with my Chinese.
Well, Jeremy, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us here on this podcast. Now, if people want to read some of these stories, you know, the Chinese wuxia novels or anything, where can they find you?
The easiest is to go to my website. So the website is jeremybai.com, jeremybai.com. And I have links there to all of my works. I have a YouTube channel. I have a podcast, not as professional as yours. I talk to people who are content creators of Asian fantasy genres. I have a tabletop role-playing game I wrote that is a wuxia role-playing game. It recently won an Annie. So you can find that on my website, and I also have translations and novels and all sorts of stuff. So jeremybai.com, and you can get all of those links.
Well, Jeremy, thank you so much for taking the time to share this with us. It's been fascinating, and I've really enjoyed this. Thanks so much.
It's been my pleasure and a great honor. Thanks for having me on.
You have been listening to the You Can Learn Chinese podcast. Help us spread the word by sharing this with your friends, classmates, teachers, cousins, bug catcher, cool whip eater, selective listener, ball chaser, rope climber, boat racer, and that one gal named Cora. You can subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And please write us a review so we know how we're doing. You can find us on Facebook and at mannercompanion.com. Apologies to John Cena, we just ran out of time. The You Can Learn Chinese podcast is produced by myself, Jared Turner, and our editor is Kaiser Guo at SubChina. And our interview editor is James Harper with Filter Productions. And I'd like to thank our guest, Jeremy Bai, and of course, thanks to my co-host, the man, the myth, the legend, John Pazdan. See you next time.